From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September when a state Supreme Court justice in Rensselaer County ordered that a man relinquish his guns. Robert King of Steventown became the first person to give up his firearms under New York's new so-called red flag law. According to the Albany Times-Union, King surrendered a pistol and more than a half dozen rifles after state police said he shot the pistol and struck a neighbor's car. An investigator said King later indicated he would take his own life. King's weapons will be returned in September of next year, unless there's evidence to extend the order. New York is now one of 17 states and the District of Columbia to pass red flag laws. That legislation allows law enforcement, families, school leaders at times, to ask courts to seize firearms from people deemed an extreme risk to themselves or others. It also prevents those individuals from purchasing firearms. New York's law passed on August 24th. According to the Unified Court System, between that date and October 30th, there were 129 extreme risk protection orders in the state, nearly 60% of them in Suffolk County. Spectrum News reports that there are three active orders in western New York. Now, the law has generated much debate. Supporters argue it can protect individuals and groups from potential violent incidents, including mass shootings, mass school shootings even. Critics say it infringes on individual rights, and the government has no place confiscating firearms when no crime has been committed. An upcoming panel hosted by the Monroe County Bar Association is going to pull together members of law enforcement, school leadership, attorneys, discussing the law from a wide range of angles, including what safeguards are in place to ensure due process. We're going to preview that panel and talk red flag laws this hour with our guests. And in studio, we welcome the Honorable Richard Dollinger. Rick is Supervising Justice of Matrimonial Parts in 7th Judicial District and the Supervising Judge for Town and Village Courts in the 7th. Welcome, Rick. Great to have you here in studio.
Thanks, Evan. It's great to be here. Finally back after about a 10-year hiatus.
Yeah, you are a longtime frequent guest, and you've worn many hats in our community. It's great to have you here. And with us on the line is Paul Simonelli, Second Amendment expert and attorney at Simonelli & Simonelli, and counsel to Monroe County Sheriff Todd Baxter. Paul, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Oh, great to be back. Doing well, talking to you from New Orleans today.
Well, thank you for taking the time, Paul. And Paul will be part of the conversation on Friday. So first, Judge, why don't you tell us about what's coming up on Friday?
Paul is really the expert on both the statute and the procedural steps that are necessary to implement it. What I wanted to do, Paul, is just set a little table quickly. First of all, as a judge, I cannot comment and won't on why this law is in place. That's a public policy decision left to the legislature. If any of the listeners want to talk about that, they ought to go talk to the members of the state legislature. Secondly, and I think Paul will emphasize this, this is clearly a new law, but it implicates a whole bunch of things that police and law enforcement in this community have done in the past, involving mental health arrests, involving assessments of those who have mental health difficulties. And the third thing I wanted to say, and then I'm going to turn it over to Paul to sort of kick off the discussion of how this statute works and what's involved, is, and I can do this because Paul works for the sheriff. I'm going to extol the work of the sheriff and the Rochester Police Department in advance of Paul's comments. We have a superbly trained and sophisticated law enforcement group in this community. Whether it's the Rochester Police Department or the Sheriff's Department or other local police departments, including that in my hometown in Brighton, these law officers are trained on mental health issues, on the difficult and sometimes threatening, Paul will talk about that, circumstances under which law enforcement interacts with the public. And I just want to commend the work not only of the Rochester Police Department, but Sheriff Baxter and his staff. Paul's working with them. We have a tremendous set of skills in this community for implementing this law. And I couldn't be more endorsing the work of our law enforcement. This is new. It's a new law. It has new obligations and new challenges. But we've got the law enforcement personnel to be able to deal with this in an enormously responsible, sophisticated way where we attend to the issue that Evan mentioned, which is balancing the need to protect individuals and the public and at the same time providing with due process and respect for individuals who come into this system. So, Paul, with that as a preface, I'm going to kick it over to you, and let's chat for a couple minutes about the extreme risk order protection orders and where we go to from there. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks, Your Honor. That's very complimentary, and I agree with everything you've said so far about law enforcement. Just to build on that, before we jump into our actual situation here in New York, it's really more than just law enforcement, too. We're very blessed, once again, in Monroe County. We have a great Monroe County Office of Mental Health. We have, in the private sector, people that are very involved in what's going on in their pieces of this community. And so it's an effort to keep the community safe. Is not law enforcement is, unfortunately, is often put in a reactionary situation. But really, it's everybody in the community, including individuals, that make sure that the community stays safe. And this new law that took effect on August 24th really requires much more than just police involvement. It really does involve everybody in the system. And I know you've got Mark Concordia coming on in the second half of the show to talk about how that plays into it. But it really is, it's a group effort. And that's really where the strength of government comes from, is when you have different pieces of government, different organizations within government working together and knocking down the stovepipes that keep people in their own little world. And when they work together, government really can do a great job and prevent these bad things from happening almost all the time. And they do so, and you don't hear about the victories. You just hear about the failures. So, but every single day, law enforcement's working with the Office of Mental Health, with private industry and those to try to make sure that the community stays safe, and it's an effort that takes input from everybody in our community.
Paul, I want to ask kind of a general question about red flag laws to begin with, and base it on some of the criticism I've heard of such laws. I mean, again, the idea is these laws are going to help us head off shooting incidents before they happen, whether it's self-inflicted harm, harming others, mass shootings. The criticism that I've heard, you know, in various quarters and in various states where these laws have been debated and sometimes passed, is essentially that existing laws are more than enough to remove firearms from individuals who are truly either breaking the law already or deemed to be a risk. And that the red flag laws in states like New York, this is what the critics have said, are not necessary, that you really can't have a red flag law and protect individual rights, that the slippery slope is really strong there in terms of individual rights of gun ownership, because most of the time you're going to be talking about people who have committed no crime, or what advocates would say, no crime yet, but no crime. So how do you feel about red flag laws in general, and was this needed, Paul?
Well, first, I have a general belief that we should limit government to the exact roles that it should be involved in and not in every facet. And I also, have a very strong belief that it's the role of individuals to make sure that they're, the Bill of Rights was not about giving the government authority, it was about protecting people from the government. So whether it's First Amendment, Second Amendment, all the way up through the first 10, it's something, it's there to protect the people. That being said, there are many laws on the book, and New York had a fairly involved set of laws that gave options to the courts, to police agencies, to mental health folks to deal with this, to deal with the circumstance. One of the issues you were quoting out of a Times Union Albany.
Yeah, that's right.
In the beginning, I think one of the things that jumped out at me in that when I read that article is that they said that most of these are happening in Suffolk County and they're doing them preemptively. They're actually getting these orders against people who don't even own guns, just in case they wanted to buy guns. And so once again, we're always fearful of the government overreaching. And this is the first time that I know of in my adult lifetime where I've seen something where the protections of the Fourth Amendment are just completely thrown out, where a judge, without probable cause to believe any type of crime is being committed, will be committed, or has been committed, can sign an order just saying search someone's home. And that just opens, I'm just thinking of all the possibilities. So they go in there to recover two rifles you own, but while they're in there, they're looking everywhere and they're seeing everything and they're violating your privacy in every regard when they're called upon to do that. So that's the challenging part about this, trying to balance safety of the community with individual liberties. And that, I don't know that there's any, there's no per, there can't be any perfect red flag law. And I don't think there's any way that you can fully, people are sacrificing some of their individual liberties where these laws exist.
And so, given the fact that this law has passed, is that what you just described, is that kind of a worst case? Do you view the worst case scenario being that there will be dozens or hundreds of such requests for confiscation on a yearly basis, and they become... I'm searching for the proper word, Paul, that would say that the request for confiscation become a little bit more, sort of broader in reason, as opposed to the case out of Steventown where, apparently a guy fires a pistol, strikes a neighbor's car, talks about taking his own life. That's different than some of what the critics have said is the worst case. How do you view the worst case scenario?
Well, I think, once again, I think it, every time we have that, let's look at, talk about Parkland. Since Florida's had this law in effect, they have put the police, and only the police, I think the police are limited to who can do it in Florida, and I think school officials, but not individuals. Well, they've had over 2,500 of them just since the law passed last year in Florida. That's a lot. I can't conceive a world where there's that many people that rise to the standard that the law requires, at least in New York, to confiscate their firearms. It's just inconceivable to me. And once again, is it going to be overreached by the government? You talk about the extreme case. There really is no data yet on these red flag laws to say whether. But once again, many times things are interrupted early in a process, and there's a lot more that goes into this than just guns and someone who's disgruntled. There's a lot of psychiatrists out there that talk about the theory of coupling, that, I'm only going to do something bad if I can do it with my gun versus, well, if you take my guns away, am I going to drive my car down the sidewalk and hurt people? So there's some studies out there that believe that there's this coupling theory that puts the implement together with the desire, but that's not fully supported. So if you take away someone's guns, are they going to find another means? Suicide's the main way people are killed with guns. They kill themselves. Almost three quarters of the deaths with guns are suicide. Well, you go to a place like Canada that has almost an identical suicide rate and no guns. So I don't know that this coupling thing is, a valid theory or not. So, there's a lot more pieces that go into this than just thinking we're going to fix it by taking someone's guns away in the short term.
Okay, but now that we have the law here, why don't you tell us how your understanding of the law, how it is intended to work, what you're going to be looking for, and the standards that the law is going to put in place, what the process is going to look like. I'll start with Paul, and then I'm going to ask Rick, if he could, to kind of talk about the implications from a number of different angles here. But go ahead, Paul.
All right. So in New York, we have one or two things that are different than some of the other states. Police officers, a district attorney, a school administrator, or a family or household member can apply for one of these extreme risk protection orders. A family or household member is broadly defined, and I can't go through it. There's about 100 variations.
Okay.
If you're married to the person, or you have a family member that's married to them, or you're related by blood, or you've actually just lived with them for any period of time, or if you have a child, even if you're not living with them. So it's a very broad definition. So there's a lot of people that can do it here in New York. The interesting thing about this, a person can file this petition themselves. In fact, New York State's developed a website that goes line by line and tells someone how to fill out the paperwork to do it. There is a filing fee, but the court can waive the filing fee. It has to, the day that a person files it, which is unique to this too, the day the person files the petition, it has to be heard by a judge. So that exact, you know, if you file it at 1 o'clock before a judge goes home, a Supreme Court justice is going to hear this matter, and they're going to swear you in and ask you to tell the court why you think that this person is a risk to themselves or others, and any supporting documentation that you have that may help support that, any other witnesses you want to bring along. That day, the judge has to render a decision, and the judge has two choices. He can deny your petition, or he can grant a temporary extreme risk protection order. If he grants either way, though, interestingly, the judge can consider everything you're saying to him complete BS, and there's no credibility or validity or anything. But the law requires the judge, within a very short period of time, less than a week, to hold a hearing to decide whether he's going to issue a final order. That's even though he's already decided that the information in front of him is not high enough standard. So the court loses its ability to say, we're done with this. So there has to be at least one more hearing, and the person who's named on there is the respondent, the person whose firearms you're trying to have taken away. They have to be put on notice. They have to be served with a notice that they have to be in court in 2 or 3 or 5 days to appear before this judge and let the judge make a determination himself. So that's, and in that interim period, the other thing is that the court can also take the petitioner's name off. So you, as a respondent, could receive this paper saying you have to come to court and defend yourself, and you won't know who you're defending yourself against. So you literally have no notice on who's filed this paperwork against you, potentially. So it does put the respondent in a very, in a significant position. Now, the police can request that you surrender your weapons when they serve you with this paperwork, or the judge can order, if he has granted the temporary order, he can order different levels of searches to ensure that they recover your firearms and long guns. So there's some, and this is where, you know, much of the controversy is going to come from. The worst case scenario for a respondent is the judge can issue an order that the police can come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, knock down your door with no notice, and seize whatever firearms you have in your house. And you can have absolutely no advance notice of this when it happens, which creates a dangerous situation potentially.
Judge Dellinger, what do you see the implications being in that way for individual rights?
Well, this discussion with Paul and in our discussion of the panel for the Bar Association, the movie that always comes to mind is Minority Report, which is Tom Cruise's movie about what can the government do if they detect someone is interested in committing a crime of any nature? How does the government respond? And Paul really hit it on the head. The issues that we are commonly associated with the Fourth Amendment, the requirement that there be probable cause, the requirement that there be a warrant accompanying an application for a search. This law is Paul, would you describe it as an approximate duplication of the Fourth Amendment? I mean, it has some Fourth Amendment characteristics to it, and at least in my review of it, there's some that are missing. But my point is the extreme risk and the threat assessment is what triggers the reaction of government. The other thing I wanted just to mention, a couple quick things, Paul. These matters are being heard in Monroe County Supreme Court by Justice Thomas Moran. Justice Moran, as many of your viewers may know, is the former district attorney of Livingston County. He has been running the gun portion of the criminal justice matters in the Hall of Justice for a couple of years. He's got great experience. I think he's got a very strong sensitivity to the need to protect people and the need to protect people's rights. I have every confidence that he can do this and do it well. The other thing I just wanted to mention is this is a proof question. There's going to be an application by a family member, or a school district, or someone who's going to say that this individual is in a position where they pose an extreme risk or extreme threat to either themselves or others. And that's really the nub of this, and that's why I think Paul Simonelli's comment about this is going to take some time to work out, Evan. We've got to deal with the burden of proof issues. We haven't had a large number of applications yet in Monroe County, although I think some will be coming as more and more people become aware of this law and school districts and others consider it.
And if I could just jump in, though, for Paul, because, you know, when you say, Paul, we don't really have data that indicates either a need or an efficacy of red flag laws. Let me just read a couple of points, and I want to get your take on these cases, because as we mentioned, New York State is now one of, I think, 17 states and the district doing this. The LA Times reported in August the following: 4 years after California became one of the first states to expedite the removal of guns from people seen as a public danger by family members or law enforcement, its red flag law appears to be helping to reduce the chance of mass shootings, according to a new study released by the UC Davis School of Medicine. UC Davis researchers examined 21 cases of individuals who had firearms removed from them or purchases blocked because of court orders. The researchers found that none of the individuals was later involved in any gun-related violence. And they admit, here's a quote from Garen Wintemute, a professor of emergency medicine and the director of the Violence Prevention Research Program, quote, "We can't prove that those orders are responsible for the outcome, but there is an obvious logic to it, that if somebody is posing an imminent threat, whether it's to others or to themselves, and firearms are a part of that threat, recovering the firearms can help reduce the threat. Most subjects did make explicit threats and did own firearms previously, according to the study." And so in that case, what they're saying is, best they can tell, and you're never going to be able to fully prove something that didn't happen would have happened, but they believe that the law is working. And then a 2016 study published in the journal Law and Contemporary Problems analyzed data from 762 gun removals under Connecticut's risk warrant law and determined that there was one averted suicide for every 10 to 11 gun seizure cases. I mean, that would be a lot of averted suicide, and we know that suicide often happened when with a firearm. So, Paul, what do you make of those studies?
Well, the second one you spoke of, probably, you know, first of all, when I hear 21 cases, that's nothing more than anecdotal. So when we talk about California, I don't know that they can say anything. Once again, it sounds like the folks in California are proponents of this coupling theory that the action is tied, or the result is tied to an implement to, you know, to do that. So the gun is tied to the risk, the way from what you read. So it's, but 21 cases, I don't know that we can tell anything from it. 700 cases, are people not going to commit suicide if they don't have a gun? I don't know. Once again, there's research that goes both ways. But have there been any mass shootings prevented? I don't think there's enough information out there yet to make any sort of determination. Obviously, it flows that if you take all of someone's guns away, unless they get one illegally, they're not going to do whatever they're going to do with a gun.
Sure.
I just want to, Paul, can I just interject? I want to flip one side of this. One of the other advantages of this law, and I'd be interested in your perspective, is that it may get people into mental health treatment quicker, in the sense that they're the subject of an application or a petition. The petition is either withdrawn or dismissed, but the person who's the subject, the respondent, I think the government apparatus, whether it's law enforcement or mental health folks, will be able to intervene to someone who's going through a period of agitation or disquiet or breakdown. I think that's the other flip side of this, is not necessarily strict adherence to the statute and its requirements, but the notion that it might be, there may be more treatment available to those in distress.
Correct. And we've seen that with where applications have been withdrawn and people have been brought before a court under Section 9.43 of the mental health law, which allows a court to order someone be brought before them for the judge to make an initial determination. The standard in the law is a fairly high standard. Likelihood to result in serious harm, it means substantial risk of physical harm to himself or to others. And that's Section 9.39 of the mental health law. And the courts have the authority. Office of Mental Health has authority to bring people before a judge. The police have authority to bring people before a judge to see if that standard is met. And so adding the extreme risk orders of protection to this. It's the same standard that existed in three or four different arenas and ways to get before a judge to determine whether or not a person needed treatment, either voluntarily or involuntarily. So the component with the red flag law is that the guns are taken preemptively, where under those other circumstances that a person is brought before the court, it would happen after the fact.
Before I let Paul go, because we're going to bring in Mark Concordia in our second half hour and talk about how threat assessments are made and how really we ought to be deciding who should and should not have firearms. Jeff writes to the program to say, is there a penalty for falsely reporting or filing a petition? For example, what happens if a disgruntled person falsely accuses a household member, a boss, a coworker, or an ex just to make their life difficult? Paul?
There is nothing in the law, but there's nothing in the law precluding it from happening. With the other items, I mean, coming through the courts, coming through the Office of Mental Health, coming through police arrest, there are limitations on civil liability. Under this law, there are no limitations under civil liability. So, yes, I think plaintiff's attorneys will be finding a new cause of action for this. And just in finishing up with you, Evan, I just want to say it's going to take a while. There haven't been any decisions written in New York yet by any of the judges in New York. The law hasn't been tested yet. I think a year or two from now, we should have another discussion and see where the law's evolved over that point, because we really, until there are enough examples and where the law has been challenged, I don't know that we know where it's going to end up.
Yeah, I would say anytime you can get a bigger sample size, there's no question about it. I know Rick wants to jump in on that point.
I just wanted to jump in with one thing. The statute does provide, and I want to double check this, Paul, that the court may redact the name and address of the petitioner if it finds that the disclosure of the address or other contact information would pose a risk. So you could actually have someone who goes through this process who may not know who the petitioner is.
Judge, I don't know how much I can ask you to weigh in with your personal thoughts, but do you have a problem with that?
Well, the whole point of this is to deal with the immediate threat. I think eventually I would suspect that due process will require that the respondent, the person to whom it's directed, the person who is having their weapons confiscated, will have to be able to know at some point who their accuser was and what information the accuser relied on in seeking the petition. I think it's done on a confidential basis immediately to protect them through the process.
Yep.
But I would also expect that at some point that disclosure is going to have to be made.
Well, I mean, I would think at the very least, if there is a denial of the petition, then I think the person who went through that process probably ought to know who was making the claim. We will see if there is any sort of abuse of the law. Paul, last question, then I'll let you go. Because when I mentioned the California study and the LA Times reporting on 21 cases, I'm not a paid researcher, but I think I agree with you when I say 21 cases is a pretty small sample size. We need a lot more data before we declare that something is working or not working. But a listener writes in from Canada, actually listening in Vancouver, to point us to some data from World Population Review, which essentially says when you look at crime rates in the U.S. and Canada, the non-gun related crime is roughly equal in the United States and Canada. Add in guns, and all of a sudden things look very different. The non-gun related murder rates are near identical in the United States and Canada. But when you then add guns, America's rate is about three times Canada's. So what Dave is saying is there is a logic to a red flag gun law, even if there are flaws to it, because the presence of guns alone leads to more deadly situations.
And I would suggest he's leaving one word out of his statement to you, and that's how illegally possessed guns. There are almost 400 million firearms in the United States. So, and how many of the crimes are done with legally possessed firearms? And what we're talking about now is a statute that doesn't focus on anything on the crime of illegally possessing a gun. This is a legally possessed gun. So I understand what you're saying, but I don't think there's any, you can't compare illegally possessed guns used in crimes with this statute possibly having any effect on saving lives.
Paul.
No, I was just going to add, Paul's absolutely correct. We're at the early stages of this, Evan. I think this is going. We're going to have to wait to see how all this comes out in the wash. And I think to have a big enough sample size and to be able to do some analysis, we're probably looking 5 years down the road. But having said that, this is the law.
Yep.
Paul knows we've got to apply it. Certainly the judges know we've got to apply it. And we're going to figure out what happens.
Paul, right. As always, if you want to offer some final thoughts, it sounds like you want to jump back in. Go ahead, Paul.
Just one thing that we haven't discussed at all. So guns have been taken away, and we haven't talked about getting someone getting their guns back. And the way the law is written right now, it puts the burden, and it's just potentially not the respondent. It says if you look at the statute, it talks about possess firearms, and that means under the law, that means exercising dominion and control. So let's say, Evan, you and I are brothers, and you have 10 guns, and I have 5 guns, and they come to take my guns away. But the person who petitioned the court says, Paul also has the combination for Evan's safe because Paul and Evan go hunting together, and they share their guns all the time. The court can order you, a person who's not even a participant in this process, to have your gun seized because I have access to your guns. Now, when you want to go get your guns back, it's not you saying, Judge, I want my guns back. The law puts the burden on you to prove that you're qualified to have your guns. And it puts a burden on me to prove I'm qualified to have my guns. So what it does, it shifts the burden also after the guns have been seized. And like I said, someone who's not even a part of this process can be scooped up in the whole thing.
Paul is probably, of all the people, that when you think about gun rights and the protection of gun rights in Western New York, Paul Simonelli is one of the leaders in the voices that are calling us on us to be careful about what laws do and do not do when it comes to rights, ownership, and protection. And he's going to be part of the conversation on Friday. He is an attorney with Simonelli and Simonelli and counsel to the Monroe County Sheriff. Paul, as always, thanks for taking the time.
All right. Well, thank you. Good luck.
Thanks, Paul.
Paul Simonelli. Judge Dellinger, before we get to our only break of the hour, remind our listeners what's happening on Friday.
On Friday at 12:15 at the Monroe County Bar Center in the Rubin Conference Room, there will be a panel of experts on the red flag law. From Paul Simonelli, we'll lead it off and talk about the law and its impact. We have someone from the criminal justice system. We'll talk about those changes. We have two individuals from BOCES, too. We'll talk about school involvement. We have Amy Schwartz and June Castellano, two attorneys, who will talk about the effect on family law and intra-family and intimate partner violence. And then Sheldon Boyce, who's an expert on the Second Amendment, will talk about other changes to the gun and firearm laws in New York. Monroe County Bar Association, Friday at 12:15. Everybody's invited, and come and listen to a legal-based but I think instructive discussion about the red flag law and its implication for everyone.
And when we saw the list, by the way, Judge, you have really pulled together people from so many different fields and angles to who would be impacted and how this process is going to work. So for the public, a phenomenal opportunity to hear this kind of discussion, especially if you are, for example, a leader in a school district or otherwise. 12:15 to 2, that discussion on New York's new red flag law on Friday at the Monroe County Bar Association. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to talk about how we assess who is a threat next. I'm Evan Dawson, host of Connections. On Wednesday, you will hear coverage of the presidential impeachment hearings from Washington. They'll begin in the morning, and NPR will have coverage, and we will maintain that coverage so you can hear all of the proceedings throughout the day. And we will be back with you with Connections on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Judge Rick Dellinger is with us here, and he has helped put together this panel to discuss New York's new red flag law. It's called a red flag law because the idea of the law regarding gun ownership is that if the public perceives a possible threat, a red flag about a threat or a concern about a possible future shooting, whether someone might be a threat to themselves, their family, or perhaps even a mass shooting, the idea is, can you head it off in advance? Can you confiscate firearms? Can you go through this process and identify threats? That's the idea of a red flag law. 17 states and the District of Columbia have now passed them, and New York's law passed in August. So here we are, And part of the team that's going to be discussing the New York red flag law on Friday is Mark Concordia, who is an associate professor of criminal justice and director of the Homeland Security and Applied Intelligence Program at Roberts Wesleyan College. He's on the line with us now. Mark, welcome back. Nice to talk to you. How are you?
I'm great, Evan. Thanks for having me again. It's been a while since we spoke.
Yeah, it's been a little while. And at the core of this, I think, as we've been discussing, is how we assess threats and who gets to decide. So why don't you take me through the process on red flags and then how you see it from your expertise when it comes to assessing threats of various kinds, what the law is aiming to do and what you think the law will do, Mark.
Evan, can I jump in here just
one
second? I want to make it clear to your listeners that Mark Concordia has that title of professor and he works for the whatever the organization is at Roberts Wesleyan. He's one of the nation's leaders in threat assessment. His entire biography and his professional career has been in the issue of trying to figure out threat assessment on many, many different levels. So I'm pleased to be on this program and be on the panel with someone who is a real expert. So, Mark, I hope I haven't oversold you, but I wanted to get that on the record because this is a true pleasure with a real expert. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate those comments. My expertise in this, we'll start with that just real quickly. I was a practitioner of what we call behavioral threat assessment when I worked for the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. So what we're talking about with that, I was working counterterrorism. And we out of necessity, as an investigator, I needed to learn the theory and operational aspects of what we call behavioral threat assessment. Because what we were trying to do with counterterrorism was prevent an attack from happening. Okay, so we were in the prevention mode, not the reaction mode. And I think Paul mentioned that earlier, right? We're in the prevention mode here. So when we're talking about evaluating or assessing threats and case management, which we have to understand, there's a lot of confusion around what threat assessment is. And the judge mentioned earlier this concept of the Minority Report. And that's a famous movie that I have to educate people on, that this behavioral threat assessment is not that. Behavioral threat assessment actually comes from sciences, the behavioral science, right, which is basically the study of human actions. And it includes fields of sociology, social and cultural anthropology, psychology, even behavior aspects of biology. So behavioral threat assessment is a subcomponent of the behavioral sciences. So that's our discussion, is what can the behavioral sciences add to New York State's extreme risk order to make it a balanced process, a fair process, a judicious process. Many people misunderstand, again, behavioral threat assessment. They think it's like a program or something. What it is a discipline. It comes from academia. It comes from law enforcement, psychology, all working together. And through the years, what we've been able to determine with behavioral threat assessment, this is through literature and studies, that the type of violence that we're talking about here, Evan, and we've talked about this before too, is not affective violence, not spontaneous violence, not violence that occurs with heightened emotion. What we're talking about is targeted violence. Mm-hmm. And targeted violence is the result of an understandable and discernible process of thinking and behavior. That all the literature suggests that subjects will display what we call attack-related behaviors that move them along a continuum or a pathway to violence from idea to action. And that's that concept of red flag, where you see the red flags or the warning signs or the behavioral indicators that are consistent with the literature and studies and evidence-based research that suggests that an individual may have a higher risk for what we call targeted violence. So that's the concept that we here in New York, myself, have been leading some of the efforts along with the Sheriff's Department and others, along with the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals as a governing body, as to what can we add to this conversation? What can the discipline of behavioral threat assessment, can we use what we call investigative guidelines for police departments, for our schools and others to utilize to make sure that we identify the relevant factors that are higher indication of potential risk of violence? And this is not done by one person. A behavioral threat assessment is a multidisciplinary approach. And both the judge and Paul mentioned, you know, we're in a really good place here in Monroe County with the relationships between mental health, the federal, local law enforcement, our schools, our experts, our advocates, especially within our domestic violence. We're in a really good place to come together and to make sure that we utilize this tool. And that's an important point. Red flag or extreme risk protection orders are a tool. The intent of the law is to give another tool to law enforcement or the concerned parties to use when the circumstances dictate that they have to. It's not going to be, it should not be utilized, you know, just for every circumstance. Ideally, you know, we'll be able to remove weapons or deny access to weapons in a multitude of ways, but there are certain circumstances where it's just too difficult and there's too many challenges and we need the red flag law.
So, but Mark, do this for me if you could. I realize every individual case is going to have its own nuances, and I assume that from the outset, we don't expect the courts to be removing firearms if someone just made a flippant comment. Mm-hmm. You know, people make flippant comments. There's a difference between that and by the way, I don't mean to minimize fear, especially if there's firearms involved. I would never sort of begrudge anyone the right to be afraid or concerned for their safety, even if it seems like it's a flippant comment, if there's a firearm there. I think what I'm saying is the red flag law, as best I can tell in other states, Mark, it's a pretty high rate. Once you get a claim that comes in, it's a pretty high rate in some of these states of actually removing the firearms. And I'm curious to know what your perspective tells you about the kinds of scenarios in which you think that is actually appropriate. When there's a real threat, what that might look like in a domestic situation, what someone's behavior might look like if they are planning, you know, God forbid, a mass shooting. How do we start to get really serious about understanding what that looks like and making sure this law works as intended?
Mark, before you start, see if you can work in your comment about the differentiation between hunters and howlers.
Yeah, absolutely, Judge. So, you know, one of the fundamental philosophies or concepts within the behavioral threat assessment and management is that not all threats are created equal, right? The famous quote in books actually written by Calhoun and Weston call identifying the hunters and the howlers, right? So howlers are the concept that individuals may have concerning behavior, may make threats, but really their nexus to danger is not the same as potentially a hunter, someone who is more methodical and quiet and silent about their intentions. So we've spent over 30 years in the discipline of trying to identify hunters and howlers. Again, this is behavior, right? We look at the behavior, the course of conduct of individuals. There's also characteristics of an individual, right? We look at the biopsychosocial aspects, right? So characteristics can add to someone's potential risk, but it's not doesn't reach a level, I would say, of probable cause to utilize this type of law. It's the behaviors. When their behaviors are they have a nexus to this type of target of violence, or identified as the, you know, 8 attack related behaviors that are consistent within the literature, then that gives us the ability to move forward. Now, Evan, to your point about you know, that there's going to be a high volume of this. Now, if you look at the law, actually, you know, one of the I guess, challenges or disagreements with the law is that, you know, you're taking guns away from people who haven't committed any crime. But if you actually look at the law, a lot of the relevant factors that should be considered to have an extreme risk order are actually could be violations of law. We're talking about threats. You talk about brandishing, reckless display of weapons. You're talking about violations of orders of protection. So essentially, those are, you know, criminal offenses that could kick this off. So that's not necessarily accurate.
Okay.
Where we do get into some area of discussion is around the concerning behaviors, because not all people who are dangerous make threats. That's what the literature suggests. So if we have concerns, that's where we're going to need some assessment guidelines. And that's where the behavioral sciences can come in, because there's assessment tools, guidelines, everything from investigative guidelines to what we call structured professional judgment instruments, all the way up to actuarial instruments, have been used for decades in different states and in different domains regarding trying to assess behavior. Now, an assessment is nothing more than an investigation, gathering of facts, Evan, the gathering of risk-relevant facts established through the literature. Once you understand that, you can actually create these assessment guidelines that can be used by schools, by law enforcement, by the district attorney's office, that suggest higher risk or maybe even reaching the level of probable cause that an individual may be on this pathway to lethal violence. And removing access to weapons is an extremely important part of a case management protocol, because a lot of times these individuals, their state of mind, their thinking pattern is temporary. And this is concept of the pathway to violence. It goes up and it also goes down. So if we can buy time, if we can remove the weapons, if we can get them into treatment, and you referenced that Connecticut study earlier, and the judge brought up a very good point. The exact number escapes me, but I believe it was over 25% in Connecticut. The extreme risk order was the initial entrance into the mental health system for the individual. And then they continued on with treatment, which is an important byproduct. So, Evan, I don't foresee we're gonna end up seeing, unfortunately, is if there's an event across the country, you may see requests for these orders go up, because that's a fear-based reaction, an emotional reaction, and that's what we have to stay away from, because that's when we're going to not balance the constitutional rights of individuals. Not every person that makes a threat poses a threat. That's another concept in threat assessment, and we have to be able to discern that. And again, the literature, the discipline of threat assessment, and I'm a certified threat manager, we're taught to be able to, the best that we can, collect the data, collect the behavior, observe the behavior that has a higher risk of lethal violence. And that's what we're going to try to do here in New York State. So we use this law judiciously. And again, another tool in our toolbox.
Mark, let me just add one thing. In your presentation that you're going to do on Friday, you talk about the path to intended violence that starts with grievance, goes to ideation, talks about research and planning, then preparation, breach, and finally the attack. What we're really hoping is that this law gets us into one of those phases before we reach the attack point, that we'll be able to detect and intervene at one of those stages, the research, the planning, the preparation, and then use the threat assessment skills from social science to divert them from that path and bring them before the courts and see if we can work on preventing weapons from being involved in that part of the intended action.
But Judge, we've heard the term probable cause this hour. A listener points out that the standard is supposed to be clear and convincing evidence, which is a higher standard than just probable cause. Is that right?
That's correct. The standard is clear and convincing evidence, but let me just remind everyone that this is an ex parte application. This is an application made by an individual where the respondent, the person to whom the order is directed, is not present in the courtroom. And that's an unusual step when the consequence is that we're going to, in essence, confiscate their weapons. That's different. Let me just put it that way. That's a different process. Standard is clear and convincing evidence, but it's a different process with a different result. My point is that, as Mark, I think, has pointed out, there's a huge social science component of this.
Sure.
Before government acts. And we've got to rely on people in Mark's position or Paul's position or other mental health professionals to come in and say, where does this stand on the risk assessment scale, and what's the appropriate government response? Again, I would just commend Tom Moran, who's the Supreme Court judge in charge of these things. There are very few people who have his background in law enforcement, and this is right up his alley. He's used to making these kind of complex balancing decisions,
yep.
And I have confidence in them.
And so in 45 seconds, Mark, I'll close with a question for you, which is New York's red flag law will be effective if what? What's the standard that you want to see?
The standard is if there's a multidisciplinary approach utilizing a threat assessment or an investigative guide to determine higher levels of risk, and that we come together as a community to make sure that we help balance the needs and constitutional rights of individuals with that of protecting our community from and others themselves from acts of targeted and lethal violence.
All right, Mark.
Perfect summary, Mark.
Yep, Director of the Homeland Security and Applied Intelligence Program at Roberts Wesleyan, among a long resume. Mark, as always, thanks for taking the time, and I know we'll talk again.
My pleasure.
Mark Concordia on the line. We talked to Paul Simonelli earlier this hour, and the Honorable Richard Dollinger helping put together the program on Friday. So in 15 seconds, Judge, tell people what you want to know about Friday.
Friday, November 15th, 12:15, 2 o'clock, Monroe County Bar Association, 1 West Main Street, a panel on the red flag law. We'll explore all of its dimensions and give everybody a little enlightenment on new law.
Nice having you. Thank you for being here. Our thanks as well to David Griffin, volunteering today, and Megan Mack producing. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. And tomorrow, you're going to hear full impeachment hearing coverage on NPR News and WXXI. We're back with you Thursday on member-supported public radio.